agus Giadiv. Welcome to The Irish in Canada, the podcast exploring the histories and legacies of Irish immigrants and their Canadian descendants. I'm your host, Jane McGaughey. This is Season 3, Episode Number 2, 1847, The Doctor and the Priest. A few months ago, I had to go to the hospital, not because I was sick, thank goodness, but to visit someone who was. Ever since I was a kid, I've often been struck by the same feeling when I go into a hospital lobby. I walk through the revolving doors, spot the gift shop or the coffee kiosk, but then there's that smell. It's not foul, it's not fair. It would almost be sickly sweet, except for that high note of chlorine or bleach or some kind of disinfectant. It's sterile, necessarily and almost repellently clean. And of course, there's a good reason for that. You don't want a modern hospital to smell like hell on earth. That's the exact kind of thing that they hinge upon avoiding. But the antiseptic smell of the place immediately puts me on my guard. Because what am I not smelling? What are those chemicals covering up? I've said it before on this podcast. Histories of the senses, and of smell in particular, open up avenues that many written narratives simply haven't been able to explore. It's hard to make paper smell like a morgue. But because I've done a lot of work in the past few years on that axis where social history meets histories of medicine, my brain is primed to wonder what medical facilities might have been like centuries ago. When we think of the fever sheds for Irish immigrants that existed in Canada, first from the cholera epidemics of the 1830s, and then, only a few years later, from the typhus that came with those fleeing the Irish famine, the senses must have been fundamental in how people experienced those makeshift hospitals and sick bays. Newspapers from 1847 talk about the horrific heat of that summer, how even in the shade, the thermometer soared above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a very oppressive 38 degrees for those of us who use Celsius. The sweaty crush of so many bodies, the sweet notes of sawdust and freshly cut wood from the construction of the sheds, mixed with the sour, hot staleness that radiates off the skin of someone with a high fever. The wicked stench of rot and death that claws its way inside you. Smell is what makes things feel immediate and close. And the two men we're talking about on today's episode knew the makeshift quarantine tents and fever sheds intimately. They worked among the sounds of crying and wheezing breaths and groans. They felt the stifling heat that was rarely broken up by a cool breeze. They moved through grim shadows once they entered those darkened sheds. Those fever sheds and makeshift tents built to receive the Irish desperately fleeing the Great Famine define this period of Irish-Canadian history. For a lot of people, the tragedy of 1847 is the only thing they know about the Irish coming to Canada. Today, I want to look at the famine through the lives, well, through the deaths, actually, of two men who were waiting in Canada for the Irish refugees when they arrived. Dr. James Patrick Collins in St. John, New Brunswick, and His Grace, Bishop Michael Power in Toronto. We haven't talked much about New Brunswick yet, have we? One of the problems with Canadian history is that it can be incredibly regionalized in its focus. Growing up in Eastern Ontario, I had a very different emphasis in my history classes than someone who went to school in Quebec, or British Columbia, or Prince Edward Island. That sense of a national story and mythology that students in America or France might feel isn't as evident for Canadian students. Atlantic Canada has its own rich history of Irish immigration and settlement, and New Brunswick is a vital part of that. Between 1840 and 1845, over 33,500 immigrants arrived in New Brunswick, and according to the Partridge Island Research Project, about 88% of them were Irish, with the vast majority landing at St. John. Go look at a map, and you can see why St. John was such an obvious port for the transatlantic journey. Nearly 10,000 more immigrants arrived in 1846, after the famine had already begun to destroy the Irish potato crop, and 16,000 came in Black 47. But at the time, the population of St. John was only 19,000 people. I live in Montreal. We have a current population on the island of just over 1.5 million people. It would be like 1 million Irish refugees arriving in the Old Port in one summer. Honestly, the numbers are so overwhelming, it's hard to really wrap your mind around it. Given those incredible proportions, you can understand why the massive influx of immigrants to St. John in 1847 overwhelmed the city and its facilities. It's the tragic common thread that unites almost all places in Canada associated with the Irish famine. No one was ready. The sheds on Partridge Island were too small to accommodate so many sick people. In the month of June alone, 35 vessels unloaded nearly 6,000 passengers on the island, and at least 600 of them died. Among the dead that summer was a local man, the name perhaps most associated with Partridge Island, Dr. James Patrick Collins. Collins was born around 1824 in County Cork and emigrated to St. John in 1837 with the rest of his family when he was 13. His portrait, you can see it in the show notes, depicts a young man with large, expressive eyes, dark hair, and a respectable beard. It's an interesting face. Quite kind, a bit Christ-like, sure. But I think he most resembles a young Charles Stuart Parnell with slightly longer hair. And coming from me, that's a huge compliment. I am a Parnellite to the core. Collins' father was a grocer in St. John, but he seems to have been drawn to medicine from an early age. While still just a teenager, he apprenticed with Dr. George Peters, who was the superintendent for the local lunatic asylum. With Peters' assistance and encouragement, Collins left New Brunswick when he was 20 to be trained as a doctor in Paris and then London. But when he finished his medical degree, he didn't stay in Europe. He wanted to go home, to St. John. In August 1846, he opened his medical practice, working out of his family's home on Mill Street in the neighborhood of York Point. Now, York Point has its own interesting history. While poor Irish Catholics settled throughout St. John during the famine period, York Point was one of the areas that took in a lot of the surviving Irish refugees. It also wasn't the most welcoming or safe place. In fact, it was a congested, poverty-stricken area on the Upper East Side of the harbor, where the new, desperate migrants lived cheek by jowl with sawmills, wharves, warehouses, shops, tanneries, and private homes, including the one that the Collins family lived in. Many of James Patrick's new Irish patients lived in ramshackle tenements, Victorian squalor at its most Dickensian. But what York Point is most remembered for in the 19th century is its violence. The place had an infamous reputation, with two major sectarian riots taking place in 1847 and 1849. Collins would have known what he was doing by opening his practice there. It was obvious that the people in York Point needed local doctors. Collins had returned in 1846, and at the end of October that year, he married a young woman named Mary Quinn. Within a few weeks of the wedding, she fell pregnant. Okay, just a bit of a tangent, but I always think that is such a weird turn of phrase. It sounds like the lady in question must have tripped over something unexpectedly. Ah, I've fallen down, and now I'm pregnant. Language can be so weird. For the newlyweds, the news about the coming baby probably added to their happiness. But sadly, Collins didn't live to meet his infant daughter. When the quarantine's hospital sheds were overflowing on Partridge Island in the late spring of 1847, Collins volunteered to treat the sick, on site. The medical superintendent, Dr. George Harding, was very grateful. He had already let the authorities know that he couldn't handle things on his own as the island's only doctor, and he needed help straight away. Collins was joined by Harding's brother William, and the two doctors took on the role of the doomed island's new medical assistants. According to his entry in the Dictionary of Canadian Biography, Collins decided to risk his life on Partridge Island for both altruistic and pragmatic reasons. He'd been born in Ireland, and the people who desperately needed his help had been too. Collins also had been told by a local politician, Lewis Burns, that assisting Harding on Partridge Island would benefit his, quote, fledgling medical career. After all, he'd been in town for less than a year at that point, and establishing a sound medical practice hinged on having a good local reputation. His brothers-in-law, James and Edmund Quinn, were both Irish Catholic priests who had been trying to assist the survivors of the coffin ships, and they, too, probably encouraged Collins to help at the quarantine station and do his part. Against the protests of his own family, and I should think his heavily pregnant wife Mary, Collins made the short trip out of the harbor to the oldest quarantine station in North America. Once there, he helped countless victims of typhus, the disease better known in the summer of 1847 as the Irish fever. The word typhus comes from the Greek meaning hazy or smoky, a reference to the delusions and delirium often brought on by high fever. The problem for anyone working to help the Irish in 1847, however, was that there was no treatment for typhus. Today we treat it with antibiotics. They weren't even aware of how it was spread in the mid-19th century. Like the quarantine station on Gros Isle, the most that Collins and the Hardings could do was treat their patients' symptoms with thin broth, compresses, and then hope that a patient might be one of the few strong enough to survive the infection. Around the end of June, both Collins and William Harding contracted the disease, joining the hundreds of others who were already shaking with fever and delirium. The doctors had now become the patients. Worse, they were trapped. They couldn't leave the quarantine. They couldn't leave the island. 1 week later, on July 2nd, 1847, Collins died. Only when his body was sealed in a lead coffin was he allowed back into the city. But at his funeral 2 days later, nearly 4,000 people came out for the procession. That was about one-fifth of the entire city of St. John. Today, Collins is remembered best through the dedication on the Celtic cross on Partridge Island and its smaller replica on the mainland. Quote, "This cross also commemorates the devotion and sacrifice of Dr. Patrick Collins, who, after ministering to the victims of the disease, himself contracted it and died." End quote. James Patrick Collins was only 23 years old. The great theme of the summer of 1847 was death. It haunted Partridge Island and Gros Isle and all of the cities and towns going up the St. Lawrence River and along the shores of Lake Ontario. Death from ship's fever was what connected St. John and Toronto that year. And the funeral turnout for James Patrick Collins was not an anomaly. The same thing happened for Bishop Michael Power. Historian Mark McGowan begins his fantastic biography about Power with the end of the story, the funeral on the 5th of October, 1847, from St. Paul's Church through the streets of Toronto to the crypt of the as-yet-unfinished St. Michael's Cathedral. To that point, it was Toronto's largest display of public mourning. It had been raining the night before, but that didn't deter the hundreds of immigrants who followed after the official mourners and dignitaries on the casket's final journey. Quote, "These were the recently arrived Irish. They followed the train because they believed Power had died for them. He had been a presence in the immigrant sheds and the fever hospital, and he had stood and prayed at gravesides as their kith and kin, having lost their battle with typhus, were lowered into Canadian soil. They would remember Michael Power as one who had walked with them, become infected with them, and died with them." End quote. But Power's story began in a very different part of North America. He was born in Halifax in 1804 to parents from Waterford. His father, William, was a sea captain, a suitable profession for Nova Scotia. But Power is now most associated with the city of Toronto and his work there in the 1840s. At only 12 years of age, he was sent to the seminary in Montreal to train as a priest. After his ordination, he then worked at Drummondville, Montebello, Valleyfield, and La Prairie throughout the 1830s. Although we think of him as a Nova Scotian and Torontonian, much of his life was spent in the modern province of Quebec. Bishop Alexander MacDonnell asked, or knowing MacDonnell's ways, probably told, power to attend to congregations on both sides of the Ottawa River. This body of water was, and is, the boundary between Ontario and Quebec, or as they were then, Upper and Lower Canada. Interestingly, Power's entry in the DCB simply states that, much to MacDonnell's regret, Power refused to do it. Now, when I hear about the Ottawa River in the 1830s, I tend to think of just one thing. That's right, the Shiners, our infamous Irish lumberjacks from season one. Was Father Michael Power already aware in 1833 that trying to minister to those Irish Catholic lumbermen would be stepping in a hornet's nest? Priests, after all, didn't have the greatest record of success in curbing the depravities that occurred during the Shiners' War in the 1830s. Sadly, it's really difficult to know what Power thought about this part of his ministry, because he didn't leave behind a lot of personal papers. His private feelings were rarely voiced. Although McGowan emphasizes that Michael Power would not have been one to be intimidated by working as a priest on the Canadian frontier. Whatever his motivations, Power tended only to the Catholics in Lower Canada. When he finally moved to Upper Canada, it was to the big city, Toronto, and in a much bigger role, as the city's first Roman Catholic bishop. In the early 1840s, there was only one Roman Catholic diocese in Upper Canada, covering the entire province. Bishop Golin wanted help, and noting that Upper Canada was becoming more and more Irish, he suggested Michael Power as the right man for the job. Quote, "This gentleman is sufficiently Irish to be well thought of here, and sufficiently Canadian to live up to all we might expect of him." End quote. Both the Colonial Office and the Pope agreed with this assessment, and Power was chosen as the new bishop for a diocese covering the western half of Upper Canada. He arrived in Toronto to begin his new role in June of 1842. 5 years later, to the month, Bishop Power was returning from a trip to Europe, in which he had spent time in Ireland, witnessing firsthand the horrors of the famine. In Dublin, he watched as thousands lined the quayside waiting to board ships, never to return. In the countryside, he saw the effects of starvation, poverty, the workhouses, evictions, and disease. And that last nightmare was about to hit Toronto. Roughly 38,000 Irish immigrants arrived in Toronto in the spring and summer of Black 47. Most of them just kept going, pushing on to the United States. Only 2,000 remained in the city, and more than half of those died from typhus before the year was out. Michael Power had been seen as someone to turn to when a crisis hit Irish Catholic communities. Despite being a Haligonian by birth, Power was often seen as being from Ireland. His actions in helping the famine victims in Toronto have become so central to his story, it's worth remembering that he had been a spiritual leader to Irish Canadians for 20 years before he died. But when he arrived home in Toronto on June 21st, 1847, he was faced with the most serious crisis threatening the entire province of Canada since the cholera epidemics of the 1830s. Immediately, he began to coordinate efforts, not just with other Catholic leaders, but with politicians and Protestant clergy, in order to help the sick and impoverished Irish arrivals. He also went down to the fever sheds himself, day after day. Often the only priest on duty, he arranged his stole over his coat so his Catholic vestments could be more easily seen in the dark by the sick. He would hold the hands of the dying, offer absolution, administer the last rites, and preside over the burying of the dead. When, during a meeting in September, Authorities blamed the immigrants for concealing their symptoms earlier in their journey. Power explained to the mayor of Toronto and other civic leaders what he had seen in Ireland that spring. That typhus was a deceptive, nefarious disease, symptoms vanishing and then returning. So it made no sense to blame the victims for not always looking ill. Power's words put an end to the victim blaming. But in a horrible twist of irony, it's highly probable that even as he spoke to his colleagues about the devious nature of the so-called Irish fever, he had already contracted it. We don't know exactly how Bishop Power caught typhus. Was it from his daily work in the sheds in the emigrant hospital? Probably. Did he catch it while tending to his own sick priests who were also fighting the illness? It's possible. The simple act of scratching one flea bite would have been enough to introduce the bacteria into his system. When you read about someone who died young and who had already begun to make a difference in the world, you start to play that fruitless parlor game, what if? What if Michael Power hadn't died? What might have changed for the Irish in Toronto who were suddenly spiritually orphaned? With a strong Irish Catholic bishop, would the Orangemen have been able to centralize their control so quickly in Toronto and across Ontario? In the end, Power was ill for only 2 weeks before he died. 5 days into the illness, it seemed like he might be rallying his strength and fighting off the infection. But then it came at him with a vengeance, leaving him bedridden, feverish, and in unbearable pain. He died on the morning of Friday, October 1st, 1847, aged 42. So, what do the stories of the doctor and the priest tell us? In a certain light, Power and Collins didn't have much in common beyond their Irish Catholicism and the fact that they both died from typhus in the same year. They lived in different cities. One was born in Ireland, the other had Irish parents, but was from Nova Scotia. One was married with a baby on the way. The other was a celibate Catholic bishop who had audiences with the Pope. But I think the strongest link connecting Michael Power and James Patrick Collins is that during Black 47, they tried to help. In a year that saw so much loss, here are two individuals whose stories are known from birth to death. We know their names. Too many of the victims of the famine and typhus remain anonymous. In a time that saw some of the worst administrative mismanagement, inaction, and inefficiency, these were two people who we know tried to help to the best of their abilities. In a time when empathy was in scarce supply, these were two people who chose selflessness. Yes, it helps that they were white and male and well-educated and well-positioned enough in society to be able to be effective, I know that. But that shouldn't take away from the fact that they did try. How many people really did that summer? How many ever do? Thanks for listening to The Irish in Canada. The show was researched, written, and narrated by me, Jane McGaughey. This season was edited and mixed by Patrick McMaster and produced by Marion Mulvena. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kate Bevan-Baker, and our logo was designed by Claire McCauley. Many thanks to the School of Irish Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, the Canadian Irish Studies Foundation, Le Gouvernement de Québec, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada for their support. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. You can spread the word about The Irish in Canada by following us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Irish Canada Pod. Our website is theirishincanadapodcast.ca. That's where you can find show notes for our episodes, including lists of sources and recommendations for further reading. Until next time, Gura Maagif. Recommendations for further reading. Until next time, Gura Maagif.